Hello everyone, my name is Sami Merdinian, and together with Ian Lowe, we would like to welcome you to another episode of Down the Pit. We would like to thank all of you who have been listening to us, leaving reviews, subscribing, and rating our show on Apple, Spotify, Anchor FM, and all the other platforms. Today we have a very special guest, someone we admire a lot. Double bass player Mary Javian is one of the pioneers in making sure that students use their skills and talents and branch out into their communities. Mary's goal as performer, educator, curator, and public speaker is to use music to create positive social change in communities. She has toured and performed with the Philadelphia Orchestra, principal bass of the Iris Orchestra, recorded with Philadelphia, Iris, Tanglewood, Dolce Suono Ensemble, among others. She is the chair of career studies at Curtis Institute, and she has created a dynamic social entrepreneurship curriculum that develops the entrepreneurial and advocacy skills that 21st century musicians need. We will talk about all of this, all the hats she wears, professionally and at home. Here it is, the first part of our conversation with the amazing Mary Javian.
I'd like to thank our corporate sponsor, US Pave. For any of your commercial or residential paving needs, please visit uspave.com. US Pave, the national paving company. Hi, Mary. It's great to have you on the show. Let's start a little casual. I know bass players are typically chill and laid back, much like tuba players. Do you have a favorite spot to hang with your colleagues? And what type of beer are you consuming?
Well, if you're going to just talk about my bass player colleagues, because I wear so many different hats, there is a tradition we have in Philadelphia pre-COVID, but once a year we tried to get kind of all of the working bass players together. So from the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Philly Pops, the ballet, the opera, the Wilma Theater, you know, people are doing all the shows and we all try to get together on one of those nights where for some reason every show is happening at the same time. But we're all bass players, and except for the guys in the Philly Orchestra who have lockers, we have our instruments with us. So the only place we can go is the Doubletree Hotel at the corner of Broad and Locust, because it's got this huge lobby and it's hilarious. Like, we'll park like 20 bases in this lobby and everyone's like, what is going on? And then it's very open. And so we can, you know, have drinks and make sure no one takes off with our bases. I'm an IPA girl all the way. Anything, the more hops, the better.
So, do you have a bouncer at this hotel?
If there's somewhere with a violin case? We are our own bouncers. We just don't talk to violinists at night. Okay. I'm sorry to say.
I won't try to sneak in.
So, would you say, Mary, that Philadelphia has the best cheesesteaks in the country then?
I don't know, because I don't eat a cheesesteak wherever I go. But
you're vegan?
No, I just, you know, it's not my first choice of food. So people who are not from Philadelphia need to understand that if you're going to South Philly on Passyunk, which is spelled like Passyunk, but we say Passyunk, that there are two warring places, and it's like the Times Square of South Philadelphia. It's Pat's and Geno's. But what people need to understand is you can only go to Pat's. Geno's is no good. And I will tell you why. So maybe about 10 years ago, at least, my husband and I, we bought our first house, actually more than 10 years ago, more like 20 years ago, on Passyunk Avenue, before it was this food destination. And we lived down the street from Pat's and Geno's. Now, Passyunk is crooked like Broadway in New York. So no one ever knows how to get to it because it's diagonal. And, you know, everyone's trying to figure out. So we memorized how to tell everyone how to get to Pat's or Geno's. But Geno's put up a sign that said, "This is America, speak English." Okay. And it made international news. So that summer, My husband and I were traveling in Europe. I think I was a student at the Verbier Festival at that point. And we were, I think, in France, and we would meet people and they'd say, oh, you're American, where are you from? And we'd say, Philadelphia. And they'd say, oh, do you live near that place where they say to speak English? And we said, yeah, actually we do. Wow. So it was super embarrassing, but proves my point to only go to Pat's.
And I'm sure they use better cheese.
I mean, it's whiz. You order whiz wit. Gotcha. So it's not really cheese, and you shouldn't think about it.
Gotcha.
Where do you actually grow up, and what are your memories before getting into music?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually grew up in Bowie, Maryland, which is about 20 minutes outside of Washington, D.C., and I started playing bass in the public schools there in Prince George's County when I was 10. So I don't have a ton of memories actually before being a musician, because I actually was a dancer. Okay. No, that I remember that. I remember that. I was 4 when I started dancing.
Ballet?
I did ballet very seriously. I wanted to be a professional. And then I started playing bass when I was 10, and my dad would play music, classical music in the house, but I hated it because it was my dad's music and he'd play it too loud and it was annoying. Mm-hmm. But I started hearing music that I had danced to, and I've always been a really kinesthetic learner and person, and so anything that he was playing that I danced to, I loved. And I can remember all the steps and, you know, for a long, long time. So I had about a couple of years where I was playing bass and dancing, and I still thought I was going to be a professional dancer. And then when I was 12, I hurt my knee. And I also had this weird awareness that if I was going to be a ballerina, I'd have to be professional by like 16, move to New York and just only do that. And that my career would be like basically over by the time I was 40. So my 12-year-old self, this was the kind of kid I was like, you know what, I'm going to be a bass player. That'll last a lot longer. So when I was 12, I was like, all right, that's it. And so yeah, there's just like this brief flirtation with dance and then just onto music.
Were your parents supportive of this move? Because a bass is a pretty big instrument, and I'm sure your dad wanted to get rid of the minivan at some point, correct?
Well, I mean, actually, I was really scared that my dad would say no to the idea of me playing the bass, so I chose it at public school, and I hadn't even seen it, so I thought I was going to have to stand on a ladder to reach it. I didn't realize they made little ones, because I actually started on a quarter size. So I said yes without having seen it. And then when I came home, I thought, well, I'm not going to ask because you might say no. And I'd already decided this is what I wanted to do. So I remember standing in front of his chair and he was reading the paper and I said, Dad, and he like looks down at me, said, I'm going to play the bass. And then I was total silence and I was so nervous. And then he just started laughing because I wasn't like a particularly big kid. I was like this little scrawny ballerina girl at the time. Mm-hmm. And he just thought it was hilarious. So yeah, they were fine. And then, you know, I was the only musician in my family. My father did like classical music and listened to it a lot. But I was also very clear I wanted it to be my thing. So I remember being like 12 or 13, which is about the age of my older child now, who and I remember my dad starting to tell me to go practice, and I was like, nope, this is my thing. If you have to tell me to go practice, then I don't want to do it. This is mine. I'm only going to do it if I want to do it, and don't tell me what to do, basically. And they did. They stayed out of it. They kind of stayed out of it after that. I mean, they were supportive.
That's great.
Do you have a specific story of why you chose the bass?
Well, I knew I wanted to play a string instrument. I knew I was just attracted to strings. And I thought everyone plays the violin, you know. And actually, they made a good pitch for it at my public school. They said, look, everybody needs a bass player, which is true up to a certain point. And, you know, if you play the bass, everyone's going to want you to play with you, blah, blah, blah. And they also, it was great. The public school would, like, give you one to take home. And then one would stay at school. So I didn't even have to like carry it around at first that much. And the hilarious thing is that they gave me the one to take home. And they said, all right, we tuned it for you. Just bring it back in 6 months and we'll tune it again. And then they didn't teach me how to tune the instrument myself. So this is now one of the first things I do in a workshop with younger students, is make sure they know how to tune their own instruments.
Yeah. Important, especially when you're providing the bass. And
yeah, it's like tuned at the factory.
Did you by accident like snap a string by trying to tune it at home, or were you pretty good about taking care of the instrument?
You have to work pretty hard to break a bass string. It doesn't really happen too much. Our strings are like ropes. I mean, you could swing from a bridge on a bass string. So it's, never broken a string.
We're going to talk about it quite a bit. One of the main things that you do is you are the chair of career studies at the Curtis Institute of Music. And it's great that you help students get out of their comfort zone. How is Curtis helping young musicians with their development?
I went to Curtis as a student, and when I was there, we had two academic departments, musical studies and liberal arts. And so that was all the curriculum outside of your lessons and ensembles. You know, there wasn't really anything to address, well, how do you do this thing that you were trying to do? And my teacher, from the time I was 15 until I was 23, was Hal Robinson, who's principal bass in the Philadelphia Orchestra and the teacher at Curtis. And he has placed more bass players in orchestras, particularly as principal players in American orchestras, than anyone else in the past 20 years. And he's really good at it. He's a great teacher. But, you know, sort of everything was just geared towards that one path. And so, you know, when I came back to Curtis as faculty, that wasn't, well, actually, I started teaching a class in 2011, but I didn't become full-time in this role until 2014. And at that point, we were looking at a few different challenges, which were relevance to society, more skills that match what a 21st century career looks like, the ability to develop and manage a portfolio career. These were things that the president now, Roberto Diaz, was very interested in a way that his predecessor, Gary Graffman, wasn't. I mean, Gary was from another time and was a concert soloist in a different era. So, you know, Roberto and the dean, Paul Bryan, were very supportive. And just there were big buckets, like big swaths of, well, how do we do this? And there have been a few attempts at classes that hadn't quite worked. And the class that I helped start in 2011 with my partner, Joseph Conyers, who I work with on Project 440, and then also with Stanford Thompson, who runs Play on Philly, the three of us had come to Curtis with the idea of a training program for musicians to, after college, come embed themselves in a community in Philadelphia. We would give them the skills they need. They would work in Stan's program. They would get lessons from the Philadelphia Orchestra, and they'd be housed at Curtis. And we came to Curtis with that idea, and they said, well, I'm sorry, we don't actually have any room in our dorm, but how would you teach that here? And since three of us were all alumni, you know, I kind of took a little bit of the lead on it, but Joe and Stan both mentored in what we called the Community Artist Program. So the idea was just, you can't really sit people in a classroom and tell them what to do in order to make themselves relevant to your community or to develop a project. They have to actually just develop a project and learn from the experience. And so that's how we started this first class, which was sort of an ideas incubator / entrepreneurship class / community engagement course. And so then when I came in 2014, the offer was bigger, but still somewhat vague in terms of what do we need. And we ended up developing this third department over the course of a year with a committee called Career Studies. And so then I took the head of that. And so I really think of that third arm now of our curriculum as the application of one's artistry to the real world and to society. You know, when I say real world, I don't say that in terms of like, okay, not the fun stuff, like, you know, this is the stuff you just have to do. I really see it as all part of the same artistic process. You know, the ability to conceive of an idea, that's exciting to you, both artistically and then meaningful to other people, that can then be sustained in some way, like that is, to me, the future of this art form. So giving students a chance to make mistakes and try things out and feel empowered to like go with an idea while they still have a bit of a safety net proved to be the best way forward. And we've grown the curriculum since then. We have classes in pedagogy and technology and marketing and all of that. But we really had to start from the seed of these bigger picture skills like collaboration and creativity and flexibility. To me, those were more important than a laundry list of business skills. And I really separate the idea from entrepreneurship from business skills. I think a lot of times they get conflated. Kids are only going to care about how to write a resume until they need a resume. They're only going to care about a website until the day they need a website. Yeah. And most people, you know, can figure those things out. We have office hours for all of that. What I don't see enough in higher education, in music and in the arts, is the actual development of ideas and placing your ideas into the world in a way that is meaningful for yourself and others.
Did you have any backlash from these students? Because many students have tunnel vision, right? And so they want to be soloists and solo throughout the whole world, and they don't want to, you know, go into the community and teach and do these other things that you're talking about.
You know, there wasn't a lot of backlash. I think in the beginning, certainly there are always going to be some. And they don't say it to you, you kind of hear about it. And the idea that I was least tolerant of, which actually I had heard from board members, not just students, which is, well, that's for other music students to do, not Curtis students. And that's the one that actually makes me angry, because it's so elitist, as if, you know, the best musician should not worry about their community. Like, that's ridiculous. So there was not a very pervasive idea, because I had a few things going for me. One is that I was an insider, right? I had gone to this school. I've been performing at a high level in this community, you know, for almost 25 years, or at that time, 20 years. So I was at least perceived to be one of us. You know, it's much harder to come from the outside in that way. And I think the other thing was, I was allowing room for students to choose what they wanted to work on based on what they cared about and, to an extent, what they were already good at. One year I tried assigning everyone to one project, and the feedback was not nearly as good. So I went back to my initial impulse, which was for my undergraduates that they have to take my class in order to get a bachelor's degree from Curtis, allowing a menu of partnerships in various sectors that they can choose from. And also I allow them to work in groups with their friends too. I think having people around you that you feel connection to, and allowing them. So we work in four sectors. We work in healthcare, schools, prisons, and with homeless populations. So there's a wide range there, and everybody generally is able to find something they care about. And if they're with a friend working on it together, then honestly, people have responded really well. And so the pushback didn't last long. And that was really encouraging. The other thing for me is, I make it abundantly clear, and I'll say it over and over again, this is not a plan B. This is not the thing you do if performance doesn't work out. It's like, those who can't teach, like, that's ridiculous. I'll show you all the facts and figures that show that, you know, almost every performing artist teaches in some way. You know, just that this is plan A plus. And this is a way to make your life richer, because if you're anything like me, you'll get bored doing the same thing year in, year out. And you're going to need new communities to reach with your music. And you're going to need new ideas to explore. And I would say the Curtis students got that, like, pretty quickly.
I'm sure you found some hidden gems, too, because some of these kids are super talented, right? And some of the best teachers are the best musicians. So it just makes sense what you're talking about, for sure.
Well, and a lot of it isn't teaching. I mean, to me, you know, it's really more about my work has moved much more towards collaborating with communities, because you can find creativity in any room you walk into. So finding a way to connect with that instead of just kind of having others appreciate your creativity. So it's not always teaching is one thing. And, you know, because that's sort of like I'm offering you something that you need that you don't have. And that may not necessarily be true, because I think that's the conundrum that classical music has gotten itself into. It's like, you need this, like it's Brussels sprouts or something. Well, there's plenty of people who could argue they don't actually need it. They're very happy in their lives with music that is not classical Western canon music. That's not really a great argument to make. So it's more finding a way to share your creativity with others that elicits their creativity. There isn't a room that you could walk into where you're not going to find creativity. So there's always something to work with if you're not thinking of giving it to someone.
Absolutely. Curtis, being such an international student-based institution, how is that part of the training? Because to be involved in a community, you have to communicate not only with your instrument, sometimes you have to talk to the community. How is that talked about? Or is that kind of like a limitation, or how you can work on students that are a little more shy to really go for it?
Well, I would say that most international students, you know, initially that is definitely their biggest fear is my English. I'm always hearing that. And so often, you know, their English is really quite good. Yeah. But I understand, you know, and it's a really brave thing to move to another country or another part of the world, not speak the language and then go to school there. So I have enormous empathy, you know, yes, you've done it. I haven't. So, but what's really interesting is there were some questions I would hear from board members or people outside a little bit. No, the board members are very much part of the school, but people that aren't in the classroom per se with the students asking, well, is this a kind of curriculum or are these activities really accepted by all of the students? And they would kind of say it that way, like, say, well, what do you mean? And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, no, but really, do all of the students want to do it? And I realized that that is the question that people were afraid to ask just directly. Like, do the international students get this? And the answer is, yes, 100% they do. All musicians, I find, are reticent to lead with their verbal skills. Musicians, especially instrumentalists, have chosen this voice for themselves that is wordless. And so there's an enormous amount of, you know, difficulty or nervousness around speaking in public. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that I try to teach is that if you are trying to make a connection in a room with another human, it's really not based on just being an extrovert and having a great personality, and then, you know, you're going to bring people in. That's performing, you know, and that's a one-way kind of interaction. If you want a two-way interaction, you need to actually kind of take yourself out of the spotlight and listen. You know, it's like that phrase, two ears, one mouth, right? That's the correct ratio. So actually, the idea that you're, you know, great at talking, I mean, those people could talk right over the best, most important comment in the room that day, because you're using music as an entry point into sharing ideas. And that's what music can do. It like taps into emotions that are so difficult to describe, right? You know, it's all of the grays in our life and the in-between feelings or multiple emotions at one time. The importance is not to immediately put sound into words. It's to hear something and then use that to have an exchange. So it's not about how well you speak. It really is about, are you listening? Are you really seeing this person in front of you? And just start with that. And that's the basis of most good things that happen.
Very well said. Musicians are practicing by themselves in a room for hours upon hours. And one of the things that I've learned through this pandemic is I think I've become a little bit socially awkward also, because I took it seriously. I was locked up for a year about. I only went out for necessities, and you learn about yourself and you learn about how, like you said, how we communicate with others. And since we're coming to an end of the pandemic, I've become a little bit socially awkward. So I can understand these students. Curtis, you said, was 40% of your student population are international students. So I have some empathy for them.
I mean, we're all struggling to get back to being together. I mean, I'm working on a large project that's happening this coming year with Curtis and Drexel University, and we're working with a composer in Berlin named Ari Benjamin Myers, and the central question of the project is, how can we be together? And so really, like, coming out of this period, it's not going to be comfortable all at once. There are going to be phases. There needs to be a real rebuilding of trust. Although I personally think much more based on the social and political upheaval than even COVID itself, because these things have happened simultaneously. So we're all figuring out how to communicate again. But it's funny because the Curtis students often will ask me about things like, well, I don't know how to talk after a concert, you know, when you're, you know, at an event and the people are coming up to you, a reception, and what do you say? And again, it's because you're writing and we spend so much time alone in a room practicing that we think about our interactions in terms of having this like great response that we'll be able to like verbally communicate, you know? So then we kind of think that we're performing when we're talking, even in something as simple as a donor reception.
Exactly.
But it's not about having the perfect thing to say. It is about regarding the person in front of you. So the first thing I say to my students is, well, why don't you just ask a question of the person, just learn about them a little bit, and whatever they say may lead to another idea that you have, and then it goes from there. But it's funny that the idea is that first I must speak and I must have something intelligent to say.
Well, and also innately musicians are perfectionists, right? So
yes,
I can understand your students, you know, they want to go into this, let's say the jails and all these different venues you have set up, that they're used to playing perfect music, right? So they don't understand going to a school and performing for elementary students. You don't have to be perfect. You can just play, and as long as the kids like the melody or the harmonies, they're going to enjoy it, and you know, and you just get them excited about that. But we're all so used to performing and being perfect. Everything has to be in tune and all this other stuff that we're worried about that nobody else is. And that actually, I think, sets our minds back a little bit. So anyway, a little bit of a tangent, but I agree with everything
you're
saying. No, it's a good
point. I mean, actually, the best audience I've ever played for is at a prison. We work first at the Greaterford Prison, which is a state-run maximum security prison in Collegeville, about an hour outside of Philadelphia. And then that closed down, and they built next door to it the Phoenix, and the guys from Greaterford moved to the Phoenix, and we restarted our class there. And best audience I've ever played for, easily. The most attentive, the most curious. I don't think you can necessarily make more mistakes in front of kids or in front of an audience in a prison than in any other arena. Actually, I think playing for kids is the best thing, because you need to play your absolute best. And that's not about being perfect. It means about being all in. Like, for example, if you're going to play music that's slow, you know, very often people, like, anything that's slow is sad, and then it's harder for them to listen to. But what it actually is you have to bring much more energy to performing a slow movement. Like, your emotional core and your desire to get that emotional intent across to the audience in front of you, the stakes are much higher. Mm-hmm. And kids will listen to a slow movement if you are really willing and ready to deliver it. But that's different than being perfect. And the only difference between the kids and the adult audience is the adults might be more polite and not start to talk when you're not really bringing it. But it's actually the same thing.
Yeah, they are the easiest and the hardest audience at the same time, because, you know, if they like something, they will be super excited about it and show it. And also, if you are not engaging them, you will know.
Well, and as the performer also, you know, it's a lot of responsibility. Some of these kids have never heard, let's just say, a bass played before. So you're exposing them to something they've never heard before. That's a lot of power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that family programming and school programming is the most important for that reason. And I curate the family concert series at Curtis, which I started in 2000, because I think that that is the most critical of audiences. Because if you can get parents to bring their kids in when they're young and they hear that when they're young, that is what was missing for many years and led to a generation of adults that really had no familiarity with, you know, classical Western instruments. They should also have familiarity with all the other instruments as well. But, you know, just to have live musical performance experience as a child is critical.
So that leads us to our next question. What kind of concerts have you performed post-pandemic?
Well, I gave my first concert in front of a live audience just May 1st. And that was with the Iris Orchestra in Memphis, Tennessee. And Michael Stern, the music director, was conducting. It was also his first concert in front of a live audience. So that was a wonderful experience. And so it's coming back slowly. I'm about to head to Switzerland to perform and teach at the Verbier Festival, which is happening, even though it's a very international festival. And I am just absolutely in awe of my colleagues there that are running the operations, because to bring in people from all over the world this summer is really, really tricky. But we are going to do it live. It is not going to be a digitally recorded festival. We will have live audiences.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm practicing the Prokofiev Quintet now, which is one of the bass player's best pieces of chamber music. So I'm just really excited to do chamber music live again.
What tools do you think students need to learn while in school to have a career in the 21st century?
Well, I think that they need to kind of look at themselves first in terms of what they really care most about and what really makes them unique, and have an honest conversation with themselves about what they're good at, both musically and non-musically. And that's a little different than skills, right? But that's I think first there needs to be a lens through which they look at the world and start to envision themselves in it. And those are big questions too, like, where do I want to live? How do I want to live? What kind of person do I want to be? And then you can start getting to where you're going to go. You know, a one-size-fits-all approach won't work because there's just so many great players out there, right? There's so many. But when I look at the artists out there now that are doing the most exciting things, they are really bringing themselves to the forefront in all the unique ways that they exist. And there's a lot of pluralities in that. So what's difficult is that you've gone through such a long period of very singular focus, and then somehow you need to take that skill you have on your instrument and then start to like scope back and look at the world and see where you want to fit. That way of thinking is the most important thing. And then when you get to skills, then you start to get into communications, right? Do you know how to have a conversation with someone that you're maybe interested in working with, and, you know, have a conversation to learn about what they do, share what you do, and see if there are any places where you can intersect, because those conversations are where opportunities start to unfold. So you do have to be able to communicate, you know, one-on-one or even to a group about what you're aiming to do. You have to be able to write to some degree, at least an email saying, this is what I'm trying to do. Could we have a conversation? Even just that first initial reach out seems to be intimidating to young musicians and something you sort of have to get past. That ability to reach out verbally, then in written form, you know, fairly quickly in, you're going to have to learn things like how to raise money, because you're going to start putting projects together and you're going to need resources for that. And you cannot just wait for some mothership organization to swoop in and fund everything that you want to do. The fundraising aspect is personal, it's communications, it's understanding, in some ways, like how systems work. You know, so if I am thinking about philanthropy, do I know, like in the US, what do people give to? What percentage of the pie is arts and culture? You know, and then who in my city is giving to those things? Where are places that I could have conversations with those people? How do I start to have a relationship with people that are interested in the kinds of things that I can provide through my artistry? But we need to be in the same room together in order to start to have those conversations. So it's sounding very people oriented, because it is. And so it's not about this big personality. It is about ideas. Ultimately, you have to refine your ideas to something that is interesting, relevant, and that you can get across to another person fairly quickly.
Perfect. So we're going to move on to our first espresso section. This is where we're just looking for instant answers. The first word or words that come to your mind. Are you ready for this?
Sure.
I heard the gulp of water, so that's good.
Yeah, I'm hydrated.
Favorite instrument beside yours?
Cello.
Favorite food?
Sushi.
Favorite restaurant?
Currently, Soraya, a Lebanese restaurant in Philadelphia.
Favorite ice cream flavor?
Mint chocolate chip.
Favorite symphony?
Beethoven 7, maybe 3.
Favorite cartoon when you were a kid?
Ooh. You got me here. I'm trying to remember watching cartoons as a kid. I remember watching MASH. Does that count? It wasn't a cartoon.
That's a good show. We'll take it, I guess.
I probably was watching MASH too young as well when I think about it, but...
Yeah, we'll take it. Favorite book?
It's always the last one I read, so it's Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Favorite bass solo?
I just listened to a round of auditions, and I've been hearing a lot of African-American spirituals played really beautifully on the bass, so that's like currently my favorite thing.
Favorite composer, alive or not?
Beethoven.
Favorite music festival you've performed in?
Verbier is still, I think, my favorite.
Favorite TV series?
Well, The Wire, I thought, was like the most amazing. During the pandemic, Chef's Table.
Favorite movie?
Princess Bride.
Favorite actor?
I just saw Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I thought Sam Rockwell was amazing in it. So we'll say him.
Favorite city in the U.S.?
New Orleans.
Favorite hobby?
I have no hobbies. Having friends. I hold on to people well, and I enjoy my friendships with IPAs.
Favorite pet?
No pets. I have children instead.
Favorite country to visit?
Switzerland.
And last but not least, a useless talent you have?
I can smell celery from a mile away.
Wow. That's different.
Yeah. From all the episodes we had so far, I don't think anyone said that one. So.
Or use the sense of smell at all. Celery, wow. So
is it a good thing or a bad thing?
My husband could have eaten celery in the morning, and I could come home at 10 o'clock at night and I'll walk in the house and say someone's been eating celery.
Where did this sense come from?
I don't know. COVID like taught us, right, that the sense of smell is actually like this incredibly important sense that I know it was more taste than smell, but they're connected. And then they're all of a sudden like doing all this research. So I find smell to be fascinating.
And celery is just stuck with you.
Celery. Yep. I mean, and it's not like I don't particularly love or hate it. I just can smell it from a mile away.
That's great. I love it.
It's funny how hard it was to answer the favorite movie and favorite actor. Like, I love movies and actors. I don't know why that one got me.
Useless talent. It was like, boom, right there.
Well, I think movies and actors can keep changing based on a specific role or something you saw recently. But celery is always the same.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like a kid. Like, whatever, like, the last thing I saw is this my favorite thing.
Thank you for sticking with us until the end of the show. We look forward to sharing the second part of this interview with you next week. As always, we ask you to please follow us on social media and to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Have a great rest of the day.